Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, celebrating the 2008 recipients of the James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards. More information is available at www.irvine.org. The California Endowment, working to build healthier communities that support children, youth, and families. Online at www.calendow.org. And OSH, Complete Home and Garden, offering service and selection to Californians for over 75 years. Ideas, tips, and solutions at osh.com.
From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. On today's show, while most urban dwellers may be unfazed by the current drought, in farm country, it is becoming the stuff of rebellion. We'll bridge the generation gap at the upcoming Democratic National Convention.
I got one of those new iPods, which got so much junk on it. I need Brian to help me. Hold on.
We'll also review a new collection of works from one of California's most celebrated writers, the late William Saroyan. Plus, in one valley town, they're apparently the new pigeons. And becoming just about as popular. And for Scott Schaefer, I'm Craig Miller, and this is the California Report. It isn't often that you hear the mayor of a major California city calling for rebellion in the streets, but that's one indication of how the current drought and the resulting water restrictions have rattled nerves and hit wallets in the Central Valley. But as Central Valley Bureau Chief Sasha Coca reports, the problems go deeper than this long, dry summer.
The Westlands Water District is a swath of farmland about twice the size of Los Angeles. Westlands farmers grow more than $1 billion in crops, including much of California's almond, lettuce, and tomato harvests. Farm workers ride through a tomato field on a huge machine that practically inhales each plant, spitting plump pear-shaped tomatoes onto a conveyor belt. Farmer Todd Dietrich's only harvesting half his tomato plants this summer. Westlands Water District imposed the strictest rationing in its 50-year history, and Dietrich had to divert water from his tomatoes to save his almond trees. He walks out into one of the dry fields with Baxter, his Jack Russell. Dietrich reaches under some dead leaves to toss up a rotten tomato, playing catch with Baxter. Dietrich says he's lost nearly $500,000 in tomatoes this summer, and he's had to lay off some 20 field hands.
Never again, I'll tell you what, if we don't get a guarantee this year on what we're getting, I told these guys, you can forget about it, you know. They can find work, go get it, because I'm not going to go through this again. I just won't farm it.
Westlands Water District officials estimate 20% of farm workers here have lost their jobs because of the drought. Wearing a bright green apron, supermarket manager Robert Silva looks down from his glassed-in office above the aisles at the Mendota Food Center. He's also the mayor here and says he's never seen so many men shopping in the daytime, a sure sign they're out of work.
You know, right now, because business is slow, a lot of people in Mendota, they don't have a lot of dollars to waste. And we've caught a lot of shoplifters this summer already. A lot of that stuff is medicine and just food for them to eat.
Benjamin Franklin once said, when the well's dry, we know the worth of water. This summer, water's at a premium, and Valley politicians are willing to fight for it. Here's Fresno Mayor Alan Autry on local talk station KMJ.
I'm calling for an out-out rebellion in the streets. I'm going to go as far as to say, unless they fix this water issue in the state of California, I'm going to call on people who believe to not pay their property taxes. Just don't send it to Sacramento.
To farmers and politicians here, the answer is to roll back the Endangered Species Act and build more dams. To environmentalists, water is not the problem on these farms. The problem is the land. This is the Kesterson Wildlife Refuge. In the 1980s, biologists discovered irrigation runoff from Westlands farms was pooling in this bird refuge and poisoning wildlife. The culprit was selenium, an element naturally found in Westland's soil that can turn deadly when it concentrates in water. To cope with the salty land, Westlands paid farmers to retire 100,000 acres. So even before the drought, farmers had laid off hundreds of farm workers from towns like Mendota. And selenium is building up in the soil on close to half the farmland, making it hard for crops to grow. Westlands farmers can't flush the salt off the land because they have nowhere to drain it.
They're the ones that created this colossal mess that we now find ourselves in.
Lloyd Carter is a former journalist who exposed the Kesterson bird poisonings. Now he's on the board of the California Water Impact Network.
The environmental community has been arguing for 25 years that to irrigate high selenium salty lands and to generate a toxic waste product, the drainage water, for which there is no safe disposal, is an unreasonable use of water under the state constitution and the California Water Code.
Westlands farmers are negotiating with the federal government to solve the drainage problem by retiring more land or planting more salt-tolerant crops. They're even looking at putting a nuclear power plant on some of the farmland to use recycled water. But none of those solutions will benefit farm workers, says Carter. He says wealthy Westlands farmers are simply using farm workers to leverage their political clout.
If you're around long enough in the water world, you see everything over and over again. In 1985, when they were going to close the drainage ponds at the Kesterson National Wildlife Refuge, and the Westlands put on a tremendous public relations campaign about how it'd be the end of the world, they got busloads of farm workers, and they trucked them up to Sacramento.
This summer, farm workers again traveled in busloads to Sacramento to pressure lawmakers to build more dams. For environmentalists, the lobbying and photos of dry fields are just another PR campaign. Peter Glick is an international expert on water and president of the Pacific Institute.
The lands that they farm are marginal. Why they should now be given special treatment during a drought, I don't fully understand. But that's as always with California water, that's a political question.
Maybe this land should not have been farmed.
That's a surprising thing to hear from Tom Birmingham, general manager of the Westlands Water District, but he's saying it to make a point.
Maybe the city of Los Angeles should never have been built in the desert. Maybe the city of San Francisco never should have been built on the San Francisco Peninsula where there is insufficient water. But the reality is Los Angeles was built, the city of San Francisco was built, and this land was put into agricultural production. Maybe it's a good idea today to abandon that farm ground, to take it out of production.
But that needs to be an informed decision, says Birmingham. Perhaps that means considering more than just this summer's drought or the recent round of farm worker layoffs. Maybe that means having a bigger conversation about the trade-offs Californians are willing to consider to keep this salty farmland productive. For the California Report, I'm Sasha Coca in Fresno.
When the Democratic National Convention is gaveled open in Denver on Monday, California's 441-person delegation will be among the most diverse. Two perspectives now from opposite ends of the experience spectrum. Rosalind Wyman first represented California when Adlai Stevenson was making his run for the White House. She's attended every convention since, except 1968. Brian Wang is 29, a San Francisco attorney and first-time delegate. We thought it'd be fun to get them together. Brian was here in the studio, and Roz, as she likes to be known, joined us by phone from her home in Bel Air. Roz, not to dwell on your age too much, we wouldn't do that to you. But,
I'll be 78 this year.
There you go.
Not a big to-do.
You would have attained voting age during the Truman administration. Take us back to your first convention. What stands out from that, and what do you think will stand out about this one?
Well, it's interesting. My first convention, I was really young. But the interesting part was they were really trying to get a balance in the party. They were looking for women, and we didn't have the rules we have today.
And this would have been 1952.
1952, and I had, it was in the summer, and I was 21 at the time. And they were looking for young people and women and minorities. And therefore, in 1952, I remember that was one of the biggest things, was the recruitment of different diversity in our constituency.
Brian, that's a good place to bring you into this. What draws you to this particular convention?
Well, I've been pretty fortunate to have been elected as a pledge delegate. And I think that one of the reasons why I ran was because I have attended a few other Democratic events. I did attend the state convention in California in 2006. And I remember walking around, I hardly saw any Asian American or Pacific Islanders, and just thinking, wow, you know, I'm a minority and everyone I know is pretty progressive, and yet, you know, we don't really have enough people who are active in the party. And I thought I should probably run, even if I don't win, you know, there's more people out there.
You know, we live in an age when the vice presidential announcement is made by text message. What does that say about conventions nowadays? Some people have argued for years that they've kind of outlived their usefulness. Roz?
The conventions have become more of a showcase for the party in the sense you put, you know, your best foot forward and you have a great deal of showmanship going on. It's changed a great deal because of the whole movement to get unity out of a convention. They don't want any arguments on issues, and they don't want some of the things that we've had in the past conventions. And so modern conventions are more, in a sense, of putting forth a party platform, give the time to the more prominent speakers or ones you think could move the country.
But you're saying that even though it's it may have become a showcase, that the event is still worth it.
You know, you're going to get a president out of the Democrat or Republican convention. And I really think it's a shame that the networks don't think it's important enough. I think it's a disgrace that they do not cover more of it.
I'd like to hear from both of you what excites you most about this particular convention.
Well, I think we have a historic convention. I was a Hillary supporter, and whether it was Hillary or Obama, we have a very historical convention which will be spoken of for years to come when they talk about conventions. The fact of first African-American to be nominated in America, it speaks incredible volumes of what this country, I think, is all about. And that, to me, is very exciting in the sense of all the conventions I've been at.
That's got to get you a little bit jazzed, Brian.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just as excited about, I think, what will be one of the most memorable moments of my life when I see Barack Obama accept the nomination. But I think what I'm looking forward to most is just meeting a plethora of other supporters across the country that I've been interacting with over email or seeing their names on websites. And I just know that there's going to be so many good people there, and I'm looking forward to building relationships with all of them.
Brian, I won't be here when you're in your 70s. But I hope that you keep active all these years and that your enthusiasm today can be continued for the years to come, and that this convention will be that meaningful to you. That's what I'm hoping.
And, Roz, I hope and aspire to be just as involved and engaged as you are as I continue to progress throughout my life. And I do believe that this next generation will make you proud.
Rosalind Wyman of Los Angeles, Brian Wang of San Francisco, both headed to Denver for the Democratic National Convention. Thank you both for your time.
I hope to see you there, Ross.
Brian, I look forward to you in the California delegation.
I'll be looking out for you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you both.
Bye. Bye.
Midway through his remarkable career, author and playwright William Saroyan sat down and wrote a manifesto of sorts. With his legendary disdain for the commercial, he wrote, "I think I have felt the need to be only a writer, a writing writer, and not a success of any kind." Well, you have to wonder if he died disappointed, because Saroyan could not elude success. The Fresno native would have been 100 years old this month. To commemorate that, Heyday Books has released a new volume of Saroyan's collected writing. And the California Report's book critic Oscar Villalon has this review.
If anything can be said definitively about William Saroyan, it's that the man was a writing machine. With more than 40 books to his name, from his first 1934's The Daring Young Man on the Flying Trapeze and other stories, to his last, Obituaries, published in 1979, 2 years before his death, Saroyan churned out a river of stories, novels, essays, memoirs, and plays during his lifetime. He even penned a hit song, co-writing 1951's Come On to My House for Rosemary Clooney. It would be no easy task, then, to distill the essence of Soroyan's work, which was turned into movies, sold in the millions, and has been translated into more than 24 languages. Editor William E. Justice does a good job of it, though, in the anthology He Flies Through the Air with the Greatest of Ease, a William Soroyan reader. A nod toward the title of the fantastically successful story collection that made Soroyan's career, Justice's volume includes 27 stories from that book and others, along with longer prose works, chunks of autobiography, and the complete text of the play, The Time of Your Life. Soroyan wrote it in 6 days, and it won him a Pulitzer Prize in 1940, which he turned down because of his artistic principles. Given Soroyan's once considerable popular success, it's interesting that his work isn't as well known today as that other great Central California writer, John Steinbeck. The answer to that is strongly hinted at in He Flies Through the Air. Soroyan's stories of multi-ethnic, working-class men, women, and children, set on farms and in cities, can be wincingly sentimental. His incandescent love for all of mankind, for the beauty of life, sometimes knows no modulation. It's a criticism that not only Justice acknowledges and rebuts, but Soroyan too. In 3 stories, he writes that what we think is less important than what we feel, that all of us are alive and that we are breathing. So if the style is unpleasant to you, you can read the evening newspaper instead, and to hell with you. Fair enough. But this might be why Soroyan hasn't received the lasting critical blessings of his more sober peers, some of whose works are handsomely bound in editions of the Library of America. That's a shame, for when Soroyan isn't giving in to effusiveness, his writing is splendid. Not only is his work an important record of life in early 20th century California, with its attention to the character and challenges of recent immigrants trying to find themselves as Americans as well as individuals, but it's a display of bracing, clear, even lyrical prose. Here's a passage from My Name is Aram, perhaps the most delightful of all his fiction. As the snows melted in the hills, the ditches began to roar, and from somewhere, God knows where, arrived frogs and turtles, water snakes and fish. In the spring of the year, the water hurried, and with it the heart. But as the fields changed from green to brown, the blossoms to fruit, the shy warmth to arrogant heat, the ditches slowed down, and the heart grew lazy. It's for that sort of writing that Soroyan deserves to be continually read. And it's for the many examples of such prose that He Flies Through the Air with the Greatest of Ease is worth picking up.
Oscar Villalon is the book editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. He reviewed He Flies Through the Air with the Greatest of Ease, a William Soroyan reader. Campuses around the state are preparing for the autumn onslaught. Students are already descending on the dorms or staking their claims to what housing they can afford. Managing the living expenses on top of tuition and fees can be a handful for any college student. KPCC's Adolfo Guzman Lopez has the story of one Los Angeles high school grad who's facing more than the usual obstacles.
17-year-old Marlon reads the dream come true email that landed in his inbox in March.
Dear Marlon, congratulations. I am pleased to offer you admission to the University of Berkeley for the fall 2008. Enjoy this moment and picture yourself at Berkeley, a place where you can change the world.
Marlon made it happen. He earned A's and B's in the required college prep classes at his Los Angeles Charter High School. His Spanish-speaking parents couldn't help with entrance exams, applications, or personal essays. They trusted him to do it right. A promise by his school's founder to find him a financial sponsor never materialized. 2 weeks ago, when the first UC Berkeley bill came, Marlon realized line by line what he was in for.
That's for the room and board, which will be $1,312.50 a month. They're also over here, they're paying the university fees, which are $3,964.25. The health insurance, $900. The class pass fee, transit, $57. The non-resident fee, which $10,000.
The total, $27,870.75 for 1 year at UC Berkeley. Marlon can't receive a single cent of state or federal financial aid. His parents illegally sneaked him and his younger sister across the Arizona border 11 years ago, and that shut a lot of doors. And that's why he doesn't want his last name used in the story. Marlon's one of about 25,000 undocumented students who graduated from California high schools this year. State law allows him to enroll and pay in-state tuition at public universities, but his in-state tuition paperwork didn't arrive in time. So UC Berkeley sent him a bill for $16,000.
I found this out. I just broke down. It just hit me really hard, and I just was desperate. I didn't know what to do.
A second mortgage on their two-story, $315,000 townhouse, Marlon's parents say, is out of the question. There's little equity. And the slumping economies hit them hard. They've made a living taking photos and videos of weddings and quinceañeras. Last year was good. They'd earn about $6,000 a month. But this year, their Spanish-speaking clientele isn't doing much celebrating. Marlon's father is doing gardening work to make ends meet. Raquel, Marlon's mother, said she and her son relied too much on that promise of help from Green Dot Public Schools President Steve Barr, the founder of his charter school. She's encouraged her son to raise the money by organizing fundraisers, selling chocolate, and knocking on as many high-profile doors as possible. With the clock ticking, Marlon and his family piled into their SUV with dozens of packets that included his high school transcripts, the UC Berkeley bill, and a letter explaining his goal to become an aerospace engineer. On this day, they paid a visit to the East LA field office of Los Angeles County Supervisor Gloria Molina.
I want to talk to Gloria Molina. Maybe she can help me. She has scholarship or any grants she could give out.
Marlon struck out. The aide who said he'd help him wasn't in. Strike two followed with a fruitless visit to a housing developer. Marlon carried a royal flush of civic commendations he's received for his volunteer and leadership work. For his third at-bat, Marlon and his parents returned to the East L.A. Catholic Parish, where they sought spiritual solace after they first arrived in this country. Marlon's mother reminded Pastor John Moretta that the family lent the church a Virgin Mary statue for ceremonies after Pope John Paul II died. After a half-hour meeting, Moretta said he'd make the church hall available after Sunday Masses for a benefit breakfast, and he'll request donations from parishioners.
Probably once a month we get somebody that would be in a situation like this, but they know that some of them will rise to the challenge. Some of them simply fold up and say, well, it's just too much, and they wind up with some menial job, you know, where this talent, this capacity is just being wasted.
The family had no time to waste. They needed to finalize details for a car wash. That and the church breakfast earned Marlon $1,600, and he'd gathered another $1,000 here and there. He found out days later his in-state tuition paperwork went through, but he was still short the $5,000 for the first payment. Then, the next day, Green Dot founder Steve Barr said he'd asked champion boxer and charter school's benefactor, Oscar De La Hoya, for help.
Well, I had a long-scheduled meeting with the De La Hoya folks and Richard Schaefer, CEO of the Golden Boy, and we called Oscar in Puerto Rico this morning, and he agreed to cover Marlon's tuition.
Marlon said he tried to keep his cool when Barr phoned him with the news.
I kind of screamed, but not loud. I screamed through the inside because I didn't want to hurt Steve Barr's ear.
Barr said he hesitates to pick and choose whom to help because many college-bound undocumented students graduate from his charter schools. He's helped Marlon, he said, but the uncertain future of the others still keeps him up at night. For the California Report, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez in Los Angeles.
Egrets are generally regarded as among the more benign of California's winged residents. Their graceful, leggy forms are bright spots in the landscape, feeding in shallow ditches along the road or gliding calmly over golf courses. But in one town in the Sacramento Valley, they may be about to wear out their welcome. About 2,000 snowy egrets and black-crested night herons have taken up residence in a downtown park. Lisa Morehouse takes it from there.
We've got the problem. Woo, have we got it.
Fred Roberts and his wife, Janae, bought their house down the road from Willows Memorial Park in 1962.
Two problems, the dead birds and the feces. We can't go out on our deck at night or in the daytime to eat because of the birds flying over.
The Roberts wash down their deck three times a day, and the 88-year-old Fred takes his hearing aids out so he can sleep.
I was heavy equipment for years and years, and it sort of blew my hearing, for which I'm truly thankful now.
The Roberts' concerns are typical of people who live around the park, including their neighbor, Bobby Lewis. She's in charge of caring for all of the county's facilities.
And this park happens to be one of them. It's been overtaken by birds.
Lewis says birds moved into town a number of years ago, and at first nested in orchards and backyards. As property owners cut down those trees, the birds moved to Memorial Park. That was 3 years ago.
And the city street sweeps this every day. Yes, look at it. The street covered in leaves and bird poop. It's just so gross.
Paul Hoffman is a wildlife biologist with the California Department of Fish and Game. He also lives just four blocks south of the rookery.
Nesting birds like this tend to return to areas where they are successful.
When rice became a major crop in the Sacramento Valley, wading birds like egrets and black-crowned night herons were attracted to the flooded rice fields and to the ample supply of a food source, crayfish.
This was all kind of like semi-desert here. And so these egrets and herons, you know, they were probably pretty rare in this area 100 years ago. It's just since irrigation and agriculture has come into this area that they've become so common.
The birds are protected by a 1918 law, the Federal Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and by state fish and game code. To move the birds, people have to drive them away before the first egg is laid.
Once they've actually started nesting, if you tried to move them now, you would basically be killing them all, and that is against federal and state law.
Neighbor Jane Foster wishes the birds weren't protected. The mother of six discourages her kids from playing in the backyard, and she stopped growing a garden. Officials say it would take inches of accumulated guano to create a health risk, but that doesn't comfort Foster.
You know, the rights of these birds outweigh the rights of my children, the rights for them to play in their backyard without stench, without dead carcasses laying around. People should be worth more than birds, and in this case, they're not.
Her five-year-old daughter, Sarah, puts it even more succinctly.
I don't like stinky birds. Don't like them.
Last Sunday, Bobby Lewis opened up Memorial Hall to demonstrate the only solution that has been at all effective in moving the birds. The city and county are working on a hazing plan. Next year, the birds will be met with heavily pruned trees, kites and balloons that mimic eagles, reflective tape, and limited blasts from air horns.
You want to instill in them this idea that this is not a pleasant place to raise their young.
The county is encouraging neighbors to take part in next year's hazing, and Foster is ready.
Whatever, if they say make noise, I will make a real loud noise. We'll get out there and hold a parade. Anything, just get these birds out of here.
For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse in Willows.
And that's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Director is Nina Thorson. Seal Muller is the technical producer. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman and Danny Bringer. Our interns are Dan Verrill, Alexis Kenyon, Josh Lehman, Amanda Stupai, and Jacob Fenston. The online editor is Gabriel Cohn. Our producer is Susie Racho. Kat Snow was a contributing editor. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. Bruce Kuhn is the news director. I'm Craig Miller. Thanks for listening, and is that an egret in the control room? This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the Wesley Foundation for coverage of immigration issues throughout California, and the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, rating hospital quality in California. On the web at calhospitalcompare.org.